Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I know it's not that exciting to see me. I'm not that famous. This is my level of fame. If I'm walking down the street and somebody says, "Are you Judd Apatow?" If I say no, they go, "All right."
Hello and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and we have a very special episode for you today with Judd Apatow. Judd had us over to his office to record this episode, which was a lot of fun. He's hard at work editing his next movie, Staten Island, which is co-written by and stars SNL's Pete Davidson. It's his first movie as a director since 2015's Trainwreck, and as he tells me in this episode, it is really looking like it's going to be something special. Judd also has a new book out called It's Gary Shandling's Book. It's kind of an extension of the great HBO documentary, The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling, that he put out last year. We got into so much really interesting territory in this episode, including Judd's first real response to the homophobic comments made about him by comedian Shane Gillis, who was hired and then quickly fired by SNL back in September. Also want to put in a little shameless plug here. I reference a profile of the comedian Gary Gulman that I recently wrote for The Daily Beast. Judd produced his HBO special, The Great Depression, which is amazing. There's a link to that story in the description for this episode as well. And as always, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And also, please follow the show on Instagram at Last Laugh Pod to see who's coming up as guests and see exclusive behind-the-scenes photos from this episode and others. So now, let's go to my conversation with Judd Apatow. All right. Thanks for having us at your office.
Yes, this is it.
I've been reading a lot of profiles and interviews of you from over the years in preparation. And
how have I changed?
And every single one starts with a description of your office as like a hoarder's paradise.
No longer. I just put everything in storage.
Yeah, and I was going to say, it's very clean in here.
No, I had to take everything out of the whole building to just freshen up the building and put in, you know, new carpets and floors. And I'm such a hoarder that I can't throw anything out, but now everything's just in storage and I'm trying to not bring it back.
Yeah.
And just start hoarding again because it's nice to have fresh space to hoard.
Yeah. So does the new stuff just go straight to storage now? Is that the idea?
I'll start filling up again. Okay. That's fun. I mean, that's fun for a hoarder to go, wait a second, I can start a new stack.
So we're here in your office where I know you've been working on a post for the Staten Island movie, Pete Davidson's movie. So how's that going?
It's going very well. I'm right in the middle of the process. So I just showed the long, polished assemble, we call it, which is where you just cut every scene, put it together, and see what it looks like. And I was very excited about it. And now I'm about to show it to a real audience in a few weeks at the end of October. And then we do that through the end of January. We just keep showing real audiences and asking them what they understand, seeing if they get it or not. It's a it's more of a drama with comedy.
Yeah.
So it's generally scarier because, as I always say, there is no noise for being emotionally involved. When you have a joke, you hear the noise. You're like, I guess it worked because they made the noise. Mm-hmm. But with something like this, there's no way to know.
Yeah, is it more of a drama? Because I was wondering how much the story of his dad, who was a firefighter and died on 9/11, does that play into it much, or is that part of the film?
Well, it's a fictionalized story, but it's certainly inspired by the feelings that brought up, and it's definitely about grief and how it affects you throughout your life, and it's about like trying to get over that and move on.
Yeah.
But it isn't the exact events of Pete's life.
Yeah, it was good to see him back on SNL this past weekend. I know he wasn't on the first two shows, and I saw rumblings online, like, is he still on the show? What's going on? But he was back this past week, so it was good to see him back on the show.
Yeah, he's amazingly funny on the show, and we had a great time the last few years, working on this script with his writing partner, Dave Cyrus. Mm-hmm. And, it's a real dream come true to get, the chance to collaborate with Pete. I met Pete when we were doing train wreck, Amy Schumer said, you know, the guy you need to meet is Pete Davidson. And at the time, he was, I think, 19 years old.
Was he already on SNL at that time? Or
it was before.
Okay. So he was just doing stand-up and around. And
just doing stand-up. And Amy was telling me about people I didn't know about. And she said, this is going to be the guy. And so we put him in the movie, you know, for a brief cameo, mainly just so we could say we were this smart enough to put him in before anybody else. I like to, like, just do that.
Yeah.
It's like Richard Dreyfuss in The Graduate. You're like, oh, wait, Richard Dreyfuss was the guy who answered the door?
Yeah.
and we had fun. But at that time, I said to Pete, we should try to figure out a script. And, you know, we worked on one and then we started another. And then finally, you know, we got the go ahead to make this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he's been through a lot in his life. And, you know, even just in the past few years, he's become this like sort of strange tabloid sensation as well, which I'm sure is not easy. Is it, how does he seem to you now? And is he doing okay?
Well, he was amazing to collaborate with, you know, because the material is very emotional. I wasn't sure what I was about to put Pete through.
Right.
And he was, you know, ridiculously professional and energetic. And how I know it went well is when I'm sitting in editing and I'm watching all the takes and all the choices that Pete made, I know it went well because I'm just blown away by how creative he is and how brave he is to dig deep into his psyche and his emotions and his past for both dramatic and comedic material. We had a great time making the movie, and he was solid as a rock.
Yeah, you think people will be surprised to see him as a more dramatic actor after, you know, what his stand-up is? So, I don't know if it's silly, but it's not, it's definitely not, it doesn't get too serious.
Well, he's always been very honest. One of the things about Pete is he has no time to cover.
Mm-hmm.
He's just going to tell you exactly what he's feeling and what he's going through, and that's what people love about him. They know that he's not making adjustments to make all of this go down easier.
Yeah,
he has a very hilarious, dark sense of humor, and that's the filter through which he sees the world. But he's also very courageous in talking about his feelings and his struggles.
Did that help as an actor, do you think?
Absolutely.
Being emotionally open like that?
Oh, yeah. Because he would say things in the middle of a take that I would never have thought of in a million years.
Mm.
And I knew it was correct because he thought of it. I mean, it's his character.
Yeah.
And sometimes it was wild stuff, much darker than I ever would have thought to go. But if that's what occurred to him in the moment, then it must be correct because it's coming from his psyche. I keep saying it's a bit like a Nick Cage type performance. There's something wonderfully deep and emotional and at times unhinged about it. It's very exciting to work on.
That'd be fascinating if he ends up having a career that models after Nick Cage.
I mean, when you look back at everything Nick Cage has done throughout his life, you know, he really is one of the all-time great. I remember when I first met Jim Carrey and they had worked on Peggy Sue Got Married.
Mm.
And I would be around Nicolas Cage a few times. And to me, it was the most exciting thing ever. Because it was like, oh, this is, you know, our Brando. I mean, Birdie was a movie that I was really blown away by as a kid. This Alan Parker movie, I believe he was the director of Birdie, and he just had a bunch of those in quick succession. I remember going to see Vampire's Kiss.
Yeah.
And just thinking, this guy goes all the way. And I've always respected that kind of person who just goes all the way.
Yeah. So let's talk about It's Gary Shandling's book, which I got a copy of and read in basically one long sitting because it's just, I thought it was really fascinating. And it's an extension of the 4-hour documentary that you made on HBO. The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. And so you made this documentary and it was very well received and it was great. But you felt like there was more there to do and put in book form.
Well, on Twitter, a lot of people would, you know, take photos of the screen and post pictures of parts of Gary's journals, things that inspired them. So very early on, I thought, wow, it would be great if I could give people the time to go through it in the way that I went through it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, you know, 30 years of journals, all of these photos, all of his joke writing books, these interviews. You know, when you make a documentary, sometimes you have to use two lines from Conan O'Brien to establish the sequence. But the truth is, we talked for hours, and with the book, I could, you know, show long hunks of the conversation and go even deeper into people's stories and descriptions of Gary. And then there was just all sorts of just weird, funny stuff that I found. And I, as a hoarder, I thought, I would like this to exist in a form where people could look at it forever, because his journey is so interesting as a man and as a comedy mind.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it was just an enormous undertaking, though, to put it all together. And it's, you know, it's a big book.
It's a coffee table book.
Yeah.
It's perfect for your Christmas needs.
Exactly.
It's a perfect book to give your nephew who wants to be an actor or a comedian. Or
one thing that I didn't quite realize that I found out in the book was that you were kind of ended up being responsible for taking care of his material possessions in some way after he died. How did that fall on to you?
Well, Gary had a few important people in his life, and when he passed, you know, there's that terrible moment where everybody says, I guess we have to go to his house and deal with his possessions. And I was just part of that group. And I was putting together the memorial. We knew that was important to do. And as part of putting together the memorial, I decided to edit some short documentaries and joke montages from Gary's life. And very quickly, I realized there's an incredible story here, and I should organize his stuff so that we'll be able to tell this in different forms. So in going through his stuff, I tried to fully catalog it, which is a lot of stuff. And what was interesting was Gary always seemed like someone who was living in the present, not attached to the past, but he didn't throw anything out.
Yeah.
So if you went to his house, you wouldn't see any of this stuff, but there was just like one little loft filled with boxes. And I realized, oh, everything is in there. He would just toss stuff in a box and there it would lay forever. I don't think he was ever going to go back through it.
Yeah.
Although he had talked about doing some sort of series or documentary series going through his journals and had even shot some test footage. So I felt like that was a sort of permission to do this work because Gary was interested in sharing some of his wisdom.
What were some of the more surprising things? I mean, you knew him so well, but were there things that you found after he passed that you were really surprised by?
I think the thing I was most surprised by was in his journals, he was mainly trying to say kind things to himself. He was repeating different Buddhist ideas to reinforce the healthy part of his mind. My journal is just me whining like a bitch for thousands of pages.
Yeah.
It doesn't really reflect how I feel. It's trying to get a voice out of my head. I think Gary always had that voice in his head, and the journal was the voice responding to it and saying, this isn't important. You have to drop your ego. Just focus on love and kindness. And it was his way of almost hypnotizing himself into absorbing these ideas into his psyche. So over 30 years of journals, there's very few pages which are rants against people. And I found that to be shocking and inspiring that he had this methodical approach to keeping sane.
Did you see a big evolution in him over the years that you knew him? In terms of that stuff, in terms of being able to accept things and being less angry and all that?
There was an evolution because when I first met him, he was just in pure work mode. I met him when he was finishing up It's Gary Shandling Show. And I saw him, you know, at 10 in his creativity, the creation of the Larry Sanders Show, working on the Larry Sanders Show, hosting the Emmys a few times and the Grammys a few times and doing an hour special. But after that, he seemed to downshift. He was interested in acting. I think the writing is very stressful, and controlling every element of a show is draining. And he enjoyed getting acting work and not having to be responsible for every detail. And then as he got older, he had way more interest in being there for other people and mentoring other people. Mm-hmm. And there aren't many people like that in the business. There aren't that many people that you can call up and say, can you look at my cut? Who will actually spend the time deeply thinking about it and helping you? And he decided to do that for a lot of people in our community. And I thought, well, he's just a good guy. I didn't think it was a conscious choice.
Right.
I thought he's just, you know, nice man. And if I said, do you want to come to the table read for the 40-year-old virgin? He's going as my friend. But in mm-hmm. his journals, he said he was making a choice to be a mentor.
Yeah.
And it wasn't something he said to anybody else. It was just in his private writings. I saw on one page, it just said, learn to grow old gracefully, learn to become a mentor gracefully. And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I mean, especially for anyone who's, you know, knows him primarily through the Larry Sanders Show. I mean, obviously that was a fictional character, but it was had him in it.
Yes.
And it's so different from that character. You can't imagine that character really being a mentor to anybody.
Well, that's what Gary always said when people thought he was Larry Sanders.
Yeah.
He would say, I'm not Larry Sanders because Larry Sanders couldn't write the Larry Sanders Show.
Yeah.
The Larry Sanders character was a part of his psyche, but it was a way of discussing our need to succeed, to service our ego. So you have this man who's desperately trying to stay on top and be this guy. And then he has this voice in his head that keeps thinking, maybe this isn't right. So there's a season where, you know, he moves to Montana. He tries to shut it down. He tries to find his spiritual core. And if you look at other great pieces of television, you know, that is an idea that you see. You know, this, what is The Sopranos? It's a guy that is obsessed with the ducks. And you know he just wants to be a normal person, but he's just in this role and he can't seem to find the strength to not be in the mob and murder people. But the ducks always remind us that that's who he wants to be. And I think for Gary, that's show business.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us are trying to figure out how can we be creative and positive and put something good in the world and not get caught up in this race to feed our egos and feel successful. And because we're also insecure and it's hard to not want to do well, to just service, not letting that self-hatred get too large. Like, oh, I'll like myself more if I could win a People's Choice Award.
Yeah, I mean, so he was so instrumental in your career, and you said you met him right sort of at the end of It's Gary Shandling's show. So what is the story of how you actually started working with him?
I was doing stand-up at the Comedy Magic Club, and my manager, Jimmy Miller, was there, and Gary was performing, and Jimmy just said, Gary, you should let Jed write some jokes for you. And Gary seemed to have zero interest in this. But months later, I got a call that Gary needed jokes for the Grammys.
Yeah.
And so it was right when the first Gulf War started. I was there with Dana Gould and Kevin Rooney at the Dallas Improv. And I just stayed up all night writing jokes for Gary. And I knew this was a moment for me. Like, you need to over-deliver.
Yeah.
And Gary liked the jokes. I've said this before, but I feel like he liked my setups.
Yeah.
Because he didn't really know much about music. So with every joke, I was explaining something he didn't know about music. And then he would come up with a much better punchline, but I think he thought the dynamic worked. And then he took me to New York to be there, you know, the night of the Grammys, to be on stage with him. I believe I was there with Jeff Cesario on stage. John Marcus, who was a great writer from the Larry Sanders Show, was around. And, you know, it was a magical experience. Jack Nicholson was on the show, Bono, Bob Dylan.
Did that feel like sort of the biggest showbiz moment of your career up to that point?
Oh, you know, by far.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it was happening.
Because you were really just doing stand-up before that, right?
Yeah,
I mean, and writing some. And
I'd probably written a couple of jokes for Jeff Dunham and his old man, Puppet Walter. I hadn't done that much. So this was a gigantic thing for me. And, you know, we're having dinners with Peter LaSalle from The Tonight Show. And then we had a big meeting with Dennis Miller, where Dennis Miller was helping him write jokes for the Grammys. I think we had another one of those with Kevin Nealon. And I'm just a kid. I'm not even a very good comic at the time.
Yeah.
Those weren't rooms I should have been in. But Gary and I had a good chemistry, and I feel like in a way, Gary, like just how I helped him organize his mind. Just I asked the right questions, I took good notes, and I think he enjoyed writing jokes with me. It didn't mean I was writing the good jokes.
Yeah.
But I think my vibe got him going.
Yeah. And then you ended up writing on Larry Sanders' show.
Yes.
And then also that was where you got your first directing credit, right? Was on Larry Sanders.
Absolutely.
And I just rewatched the episode. It's the penultimate episode of the series, right? The second to last one in the...
It was during the last season. Yeah. It was an episode about Scott Thompson's character suing the show for being a hostile workplace because... they made gay jokes all the time. Mm. So it's fascinating that Gary was writing about these issues that are in the news today. You know, what is hostile? What is appropriate for a joke? Should we be more in tune with how people feel? And you know, it's a really interesting episode and also a challenging one to direct because it was the first time I ever directed and it was very deep material. There's also a great subplot with Gary and Ileana Douglas, and it was all about that Gary's character was worried that she wasn't going to do a good job as a guest on the show, and did he care more about that than his new relationship with her?
I cannot tell you how good you did tonight.
I feel very awkward about something.
Oh, you shouldn't. You were so fantastic, really. Everything you did was totally right.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I like you a lot, and I get the feeling that if I wasn't a good guest tonight, that you wouldn't like me anymore.
That is not true.
Really? You spend more time working on my stupid 10-minute little spot than you have on our whole relationship. And you know what I think? I think it's more important to you whether or not I'm a good guest on your show.
You know, I'm a fucking talk show host, okay? I'm all fucked up.
It's a great episode, and it is so prescient in a lot of ways that it, you know, is dealing with those issues that are still feel very relevant. When you got that opportunity to direct, how did you approach it, and were you just learning from watching the other directors on that show, and how did you kind of know what to do?
I had always thought about directing, but I truly was terrified. I went to USC Film School and I felt that everyone was much more talented than me, and it hurt my sense of security. At the Ben Stiller show, Ben directed a lot, and I was very green at the time, and I didn't make a play to direct there. At some point, I probably would have, but I still felt like I was in over my head.
We didn't have a lot of time on that show before they canceled it.
Yes, we only did 13. One didn't even air. So what was weird was Gary just walked in my office one day and said, "You're doing the next one." Mm-hmm. And he hadn't done that. No writer had directed the show. And there certainly were much better writers than me working at that show. But almost in an intuitive way and I would say almost like a mystical way, Gary just had a sense that I should be a director. And before the show ended, he wanted to make sure I got a chance to do that. We never discussed it. I never asked him to do it. And sometimes with Gary, I used to think, I think Gary's practicing being a dad with me. I think that he, as a guy who didn't have kids and wasn't married, was trying to see if he could do it.
Yeah.
I don't know if this was conscious or unconscious, but I always had that feeling. And then later, when I was working on the documentary, I thought, I don't know if that's it or that Gary felt bad about how he was raised and how he was treated and engulfed by his mom and all of the tension with her as being a neurotic, controlling person. That sometimes I thought with me and with other people that he mentored, Gary was trying to prove that it could have been done better. that you can give selflessly, you can be purely loving, you can, you know, not try to control people. I was always surprised that Gary was so happy when I got successful, because as a neurotic person, sometimes people get weird when you start doing
jealous
well.
Anything.
Just that there's some energy around it. And he was so purely thrilled when, after many decades, my career finally really took off. It was a real gift that he was so there for me and would go to every table read and read every script and watch every cut and give notes. And it did feel very fatherly. But recently I thought that's how he wished someone treated him. He was trying to treat me and others the way he thought a parent should treat their kid.
Yeah. His experience with you didn't convince him that he wanted to be a father, though, maybe.
I don't know. I think that's one of the mysteries with Gary. Some people, thought that losing his brother to cystic fibrosis might have had some effect on his feelings about being a parent, or was he afraid that he had the gene? But maybe that's not true at all. I think he could have just been exhausted from how he was parented and just wanted the ability to have his own space and his own free time, and the idea of not being able to do that might have been something that he was concerned about. He was always amazing with kids. Now that I'm older, I'm in my 50s, you see certain people who had kids and certain people didn't have kids. But, there are a lot of people, they give so much to the world and to young people in a different way that you realize, it's not essential that everyone in the world has that experience, because they are having it in a different way.
Yeah. You said that he was really happy for your success, but I think a big theme of the book and the documentary and his life is that success doesn't necessarily equal happiness, and that they're kind of, you have to separate them. Is that a message that you took from him, and how do you kind of think about that now?
I think Gary always felt like just do good work and everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. So Gary never talked about success.
Yeah.
Those discussions never happened. It was always, are you going there? Are you going deep? Are you going to your core? Are you proud of the work you're doing? Are you making choices based on doing the best possible creative work? That's what Gary cared about. And that was success to Gary.
Well, how do you think about it?
I have to say this. I'm proud of my IMDb. I haven't done things to make money. I have done things because I was passionate about an idea or a person to collaborate with. And that's the only thing that's ever guided me. Sometimes things are very successful. Sometimes things disappear quickly and are forgotten. But I really always follow my passion and my heart. So when I look at everything I've done, I think I loved every one of those experiences, even the ones that melted down and didn't go well. I did things for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's also a theme of Funny People too. Is that character, Adam Sandler's character, has all this success and isn't happy. So did that come from, your own life or conversations with him, or this sort of, where does that idea come from, and why did you want to tell that story?
I think there's a moment when your dreams come true, and you have to admit that, oh my God, my dreams came true. I got to make a movie. Mm-hmm. I got to do stand up. I was on the Tonight Show. There are certain boxes that you check off, and you cannot believe it happened. We all worked so hard for that to happen. But at the same time, you get an experience, which is, it doesn't make you happy. It is somewhat spiritually bankrupt if you don't approach it in the right way. And in a lot of ways, it could lead to great depression, because in your mind, you trick yourself into thinking, if these things happen, I will feel whole, I will be healed, and I will be happy. And I think Funny People is an expression of the idea that that's not true at all.
Yeah.
And if you are in it because on some psychological level you think it'll make you feel better as a person, you are in for a world of hurt.
Yeah.
And all of show business and music is littered with people who thought their success would make them happy in it. And that, and finding out that it doesn't destroys people.
Yeah.
Because then they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what's inspiring about Gary, which is I'm sure he had that experience. And at some point, he just thought, oh, I guess I should just give.
Mm-hmm.
And even if he was in pain and neurotic, it's not like he got all zenned out.
Yeah.
He did have a goal and a sense of what he should be thinking about and trying to do. And I think that's the best any of us can do. So, you know, a movie like Funny People is an acknowledgement that if all you do is chase the next hit movie and you don't focus on being there for other people and developing friendships and relationships, you're going to wind up alone in a house, miserable and sad.
Coming up, Judd looks back at how he got his start in stand-up comedy as a teenager and why he decided to finally return to it over the past few years. The Last Laugh is brought to you by Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands of amazing classes covering dozens of creative and entrepreneurial skills. You can take classes in everything from photography and creative writing to design, productivity, and more. So whether you're returning to a longtime passion project, challenging yourself to get outside your comfort zone, or simply exploring something new, Skillshare has classes for you. I am always trying to learn new things in my work, like, for instance, how to make a podcast, which I did not know how to do before we started this show and think I'm getting a little better at with each episode, but you can let me know what you think about that. If you want to learn how to make a podcast, Skillshare has a class for that. It's called How to Make a Podcast: Plan, Record, and Launch with Success. If you like The Last Laugh, you might also be interested in checking out some of their other classes that are all about comedy, including ones about how to become a comedy writer or doing stand-up for the first time. They also have a class taught by comedian Matt Bellassai called Going Viral: Write, Film, and Make Content People Share. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for listeners of this show. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. That's right, Skillshare is offering The Last Laugh listeners 2 months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/laugh. Again, go to Skillshare.com/laugh to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/laugh. So I want to talk about your experience with stand-up as well. What was sort of the first time that you got on stage to do stand-up, and what do you remember from that?
The first time I got up on stage, I was in high school. I think it was May of 1985, and I did some open mic nights at Chuckles, Mineola, and Governors in Levittown, and the East Side Comedy Club in Huntington. I wanted to do it since I was tiny, since mm-hmm. I was 10, and I finally worked up the courage to do it. It's amazing that I did, because I was so terrible. There's no real way to describe how bad I was, but I wanted it so much. And so I finally got up on stage. And then after doing it for a few months and all summer, at Eastside Comedy Club, they say, hey, do you want to host the next open mic night? So after 3 or 4 months, they offered me $50 to be the MC.
Was that a vote of confidence?
It was a giant vote of confidence to me. And then I had to leave to go to school. I was moving to California to go to USC.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so bummed that on some level I had just gotten in
mm-hmm.
at Eastside Comedy Club. I could have been a host. Like, my whole stand-up thing could have started.
Yeah.
But I went to go study screenwriting, which I guess was the right thing to do. But at the time, it was a huge bummer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to LA, and you know, I just would get in the car and go to, you know, the Laugh Stop and Claremont. There were certain clubs that were about an hour away, and there wouldn't be as many people at their open mic. So you might, you know, have 11 people on the show instead of 25 people.
Yeah,
the show.
You had more chance of getting on there than the clubs in LA.
Yeah, and I would get more time. You mm-hmm. might get 7 minutes instead of 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just in that car every night. I would, you know, the people I was starting with, you know, it was like Doug Benson and Andy Kindler. Mm-hmm. We were all beginning at the same time running around doing these open mics.
And at the same time, you're studying screenwriting. So how do you balance those two things? Are you much more focused on one than the other?
I had no interest in screenwriting at the time. I just needed a major that was as close to stand-up or comedy as I could get. Yeah. So I picked screenwriting. But at the time, that's not where my head was at. Mm-hmm. It was... And in fact, I look back on it and I feel bad because I should have paid more attention at school. I only went for a year and a half. I ran out of money. But I was also excited to get into the stand-up world. I started booking some colleges and Sammy Shore started a club in Marina Del Rey. And you know, he would give me literally $40 a week to book this club, but he would let me go on.
Yeah.
And that's where I got most of my stage time to start, was at Sammy's club. And then the Comedy Magic Club let me MC. And then finally I got accepted at the Improv.
And when did you start to feel like, okay, I feel like I'm getting good at this?
I don't know if I ever felt like I was getting that good at it. Yeah. I started getting some TV spots. Dennis Miller had a talk show. I was on the HBO Young Comedian special, but I never felt like I was on fire with it.
And I'll tell you, my friend says to me, he goes, I think you should go out with a girl who's been hurt. This way she'll really appreciate you. Great. This way now all of a sudden I'm looking for a wounded animal at this point, you know? Suddenly I'm a social coyote and I'm just thinning out the herd, you know? It's confidence, because guys are so confident, you know? Guys will see like Madonna on TV and go, oh yeah. I'd teach her a thing or two. Man, I see Madonna, I get scared, you know? Seriously, I don't think I could handle that. I'd have to start out with one of those Facts of Life girls and work my way up to Madonna, you know? Jeez. I'd be sitting at home going, you know, for me, it'd be like Natalie, Mrs. Garrett, then Madonna, you know? Then I'm ready. Trudy scares me. My friend's like, Madonna, I'd do her in a minute. Like, yeah, me too. That's a problem, I think.
And every once in a while, you drive down to the Irvine Improv and have a great night.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the headliners were tremendous back then. So you'd open up for Rich Scheidner or Larry Miller or Paula Poundstone at the Improvs around the country. And they were just beasts. They were so funny. So
you're constantly comparing yourself to them.
I knew I had so far to go to be at that level. Now a lot of stand-up, you know, is these, you know, 15-minute spots. Mm-hmm. But when you're on the road and you're opening or middling for Dennis Miller, you know.
And he's
at
doing
the time,
an hour,
it's like opening for Led Zeppelin or something. Yeah. They're just murdering so hard and their sets are so fantastic. Mm-hmm. So I never felt like I am ready for it. Mm-hmm. I was just, you know, getting by.
And was there a certain point where you kind of made the decision to stop doing stand-up so that you could focus on writing and on, I guess, first writing and then directing?
Well, I just, you know, was trying to pay my bills by writing jokes.
Mm-hmm. For other comedians.
For other comedians, I wasn't making that much as a stand-up. So I was making, I don't know, $600 or $800 a week writing jokes for Roseanne while I was a struggling stand-up, making maybe $200 or $250 a week doing stand-up at the Improv. But, you know, with both, I started making, I'm making like $1,000 a week or $1,200 a week because I was also working at Comic Relief, raising money for the homeless. So that was my nut. You know, I had a $900 a month apartment I shared with Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
And I had all these jobs. And then every once in a while, someone would get an HBO special and they would throw me a credit. And usually the credit was a co-producer credit.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that with Roseanne and with Tom Arnold and some other people. And then I met Ben Stiller. Now I had all these credits and it made it seem like I had done a lot of producing, but really I'd just been writing jokes for the most part.
But they just call it being a co-producer.
Like, look, Jed's got all these credits on all these cool things. But most of it wasn't hard production. A little bit on the Tom Arnold Naked Truth specials. So then when Ben asked me to create the show with him, suddenly I was running the show with Ben with no experience. And I was making, you know, for one episode, what would be a half a year's work mm-hmm. like playing the improvs around yeah. the country. And I just thought, I think the universe doesn't want me to do stand-up because the universe keeps giving me money to not do stand-up.
Yeah.
And I was also so busy with Ben, I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. And then when it ended, I got offered a job at the Larry Sanders Show and on The Critic. And they were, you know, those were nighttime jobs. You'd come in at 10 in the morning, but usually be there until 10 or midnight.
Yeah.
So I couldn't schedule stand-up. Mm-hmm. And so finally, I just gave in to the idea that I couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's like I talked to Anthony Jeselnik on this show about he worked on Jimmy Fallon's show for a year, the first year of Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. Yeah. And yeah, he said that he couldn't be as good of a stand-up as he wanted to be doing that job. You know, he would try to do both, but after a year, he was like, I just have to do stand-up.
Yeah, it didn't work. And it was a little bit of a bummer because I was just getting in mm-hmm. At all the fun places to perform.
Yeah.
And looking back, it's the best thing that ever happened that I stopped. I don't think the mm-hmm. world missed out on anything.
Yeah.
You know, no one missed out on Judd's stand-up in his early 20s because you have nothing to say. You just don't have much to say.
Yeah.
And there were young comedians who did have things to say. Mm. Goldthwait was so hysterical as a Goldthwait, really yeah. young guy. And, you know, Sandler and Spade and Schneider mm-hmm. were doing amazing work then. Jeanine Garofalo, so funny in her early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
But I always felt like I needed to be older to do it.
Well, and now you are older and you're doing it again.
Yes.
So over the past few years, you've really gotten back to doing stand-up. So I know you that kind of started during Trainwreck and with, you know, getting up at night after shooting with yes. Amy Schumer on Trainwreck. Was it scary to get back on stage? Did it feel like it felt when you started doing it, or did it feel different?
I think I was dancing around doing it for a while. So mm-hmm. in 2008, when we were working on Funny People, I would get up and do jokes for Adam's character. So I would write mm-hmm. jokes for Adam's character and find opportunities to perform them to see if they were good for the movie. And then I used to go to UCB and do these shows called How to Make Thousands Writing Screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just me teaching screenwriting, but it was all fake.
Mm-hmm.
So I would call up Adam McKay, and one time he pretended that he was Sid Field, the guy who wrote How to Write a Screenplay. And it was just an opportunity for him to do this funny Sid Field character.
Yeah.
Sid is no longer with us. So he was doing, you know, advice for screenwriters. And then I would bring people on stage and take pitches.
Mm-hmm.
And just for comedy's sake, yeah. I'd say, who in the crowd is working on a screenplay? And I would help them work through their idea
yeah. comedically. Then it becomes kind of an improv exercise, I guess,
yes.
for you.
And I started enjoying doing those.
Mm-hmm.
But I was scared to do stand-up again. I have two kids. It's hard to just leave the house. But when I was working on Trainwreck, I think I just got jealous of how much fun Amy seemed to be having
yeah.
traveling the country doing stand-up. And then when we were in New York and we'd go to the Comedy Cellar and I'd just watch her, I said, you know, I'm gonna go up one night just to make you laugh. And she just thought I would bomb terribly. And I thought I would bomb terribly, but it would make her and her sister Kim laugh. And I said to her, send me ideas, you know, for subject matter. And so for a week or two, they would say, why don't you talk about this with your kids? Why don't you talk about that? And so I sat down and wrote some jokes and did a set. And it happened to go well. And afterwards, the club said, hey, if you ever want to get up, we'll put you up. And I was about to be in New York for 4 months. Mm-hmm.
This is the Comedy Cellar?
Yeah. Yeah. And so at the time, I didn't realize how hard it was to get into the Comedy Cellar. Mm-hmm. And I just took full advantage of it. I couldn't believe they would let me go up. So... you know, I'm glad I didn't realize how weak I probably was because, you know, everybody's watching you, mm-hmm. everyone you respect.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some of it was pathetic. But I worked hard to, you know, get the muscle back.
Was there a bit that felt like the first bit in this more recent time of doing stand-up that really was clicking and working in a way that was exciting?
It's not a good bit, but it was something I had leaned on, which is I had this true story about sitting down with an actor. And it's a really famous actor. And in the middle of this long meeting, he has a booger hanging out of his nose, but like really hanging out of his nose. And it was just all about me trying to figure out if I should tell him or not.
Yeah.
And that that he went to the bathroom. And I was like, thank God he's going to go to the bathroom. He's going to see it in the mirror. And then he's going to be embarrassed. He's going to realize I dominated him. And then he'll get rid of it. And we can get back to talking about this project, which will never happen. And then he comes back and the booger is still there.
he didn't glance in the mirror.
The joke was that I said, did he not see it? And I thought, you know, he probably did see it and just thought, that son of a bitch didn't tell me. I'm going to leave it in just to dominate him. And it was just this really stupid story. And I said, and you know, that person, I don't want to tell you who it was because I don't want to embarrass them, but they were one of the people who played Batman. and I would talk to the crowd as they tried to figure out which Batman it was. And it was just a stupid story, but it was enough to take a few minutes and get through those early sets.
Yeah, yeah. I remember seeing you do the bit about Cosby getting the paper from the driveway a few times. That seemed like it did pretty well.
Yeah. I had a bit about Cosby trying to hide the paper from Camille so she wouldn't find out. And I wound up doing that on The Tonight Show.
Yeah, yeah.
They asked me if I wanted to do stand-up, and I always felt like they asked me just as a goof, because if I bombed, it would probably be just as amusing as if I did well. So no one at the show even asked me what I was going to say. Usually they really grind the comedians to work on the set. They're just like, yeah, no, just do it.
Just do whatever you want to do, yeah.
And I had been doing this Cosby bit, but I was not going to do it on The Tonight Show because it was a very dark piece of comedy. And so I would run my set at The Cellar. And then after that, I would do other material, and one of the bits was this Cosby bit. And then every comedian was like, you have to do that on The Tonight Show. And I kept saying, you can't do that on The Tonight Show. And then I could tell that like that was the move to make, which was scary.
Yeah.
And then I wound up doing it, and luckily it went well. Cosby is still out on the road. Isn't that weird? He's like doing stand-up. What do you think his act is like? Do you think he's still talking about it? You think he like says like, you ever been in trouble with the wife? You ever like get into the doghouse with the wife? You're in the doghouse with the wife because of something that you did. Like the other day, there was something about reading the paper, and I didn't want my wife to read the paper. So I got up at 5 a.m. and I snuck out to the driveway to get the paper. And I hid the paper, and the next day I got up and I hid the paper. And then the next day, I forgot to get the paper. And my wife, she said to me, what is this in the paper about the raping and the drugging and the women? And I said, do you like your life?
So the other Gary that I want to talk to you about a little bit is Gary Gulman.
Yes.
Because I just did a big profile on him for his new special, The Great Depression, which I absolutely loved. And I know you produced that and worked with him. And I got to see you guys at Largo not too long ago at that event, which was really fun, with Maria Bamford and Patton Oswalt. And Gary is so, I mean, I was amazed after watching the special like 2 days before and then watching him do like nearly an entirely different hour at Largo was pretty cool. He's just unbelievable. But what was it about him that made you want to work with him?
I mean he's so funny and he's such a nice guy. And I had just worked a little bit on the Jerry Seinfeld special, and that was directed by Michael Bonfiglio, who produced the Gary Shandling documentary, and we had co-directed a documentary about the Avett brothers and a 30 for 30 about Dwight Gooden and Daryl Strawberry. And Mike was the one who got really passionate about Gary, and he directed the special and worked with Gary on the set for, you know, 6 to 8 months. Mm-hmm. And they told me, you know, about what he was trying to do, talking about his depression on stage was, you know, was there a way to do that? My main notes throughout the process were very simple. I just thought you could really go into this for much longer. Mm-hmm. That was HBO's note when they signed him up to do the special. They just said it's very powerful and really funny. It doesn't have to be 15 minutes at the end of your set.
Yeah.
And Gary and Mike Bonfiglio, you know, worked on that set in a way that I think most stand-ups don't. You rarely have other creative people asking you hard questions, mm-hmm. and helping you craft a storyline to your set. And we had done something similar with Chris Gethard with his special Career Suicide, which Michael also directed. You know, in addition to just helping him, you know, get it made, you know, we were there for him to kick around some of the ideas he was trying to craft. And we encouraged Chris to do Q&As after he would do sets, because I felt like people had a lot of questions and it would be interesting to know what people thought he left out. Mm-hmm. What would the follow-up questions be?
What do they want to know more about? Yeah.
And he went to Edinburgh and overseas. So, you know, that's just a type of work that I really enjoy as a fan of comedy, and also as a fan of people who I think deserve more exposure, you know, than they're currently getting. Gary Goldman crushed that special at this moment. And one thing I can provide is, you know, the ability to get access to some of those executives to tell them about something special that's happening in comedy. And it's very powerful for people, because what he's talking about is how easy it is to not reach out for help. And that a lot of people have shame about, you know, going to doctors, going to a facility, you know, needing medication. And we learned that when we did the Chris Gethard special, that people would say, thank God you're talking about this, because no one talks about it. And they feel very alone in it, which I think makes people more depressed. That, you know, the more we talk about it, you know, it's like if you have a panic attack. If you turn to the person next to you and say, I'm having a panic attack right now, it almost instantly goes away.
Yeah.
There's something that's very isolating about anxiety and depression. So it's very gratifying to see the reaction to Gary's work.
So one thing that I talked to Gary about is we were talking about, you know, Chris Gethard's special and you, and how you became part of the focus of this whole controversy over Shane Gillis, who SNL hired. And then one of the things that came out was this rant that he did calling you and Chris Gethard homophobic slurs, and it was pretty ugly. I haven't heard you talk about this at all, so I was curious what you made of that. How did you hear about it, and what did you think when you heard that?
I generally just tried to sit it out. There's such a debate happening about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate in comedy, and I feel bad for everybody. I really do. I feel like comedians generally have very good intentions, and even the ones who are doing things that people are debating, they really are trying to make people happy and make a living. And there's just so much pain around these issues. And it's made me sad to see divisions build up in the comedy world over all of this.
Yeah, there's like articles about comedy civil war and these, you know, two sides, which I think is a little overblown. But
I think there are people that feel like their livelihoods are at stake and they feel in danger when they do their sets. And there's other people that feel like no one's listening and that it's not that hard to be aware of what you're saying on stage and the effect of it.
Yeah.
And I think some people feel like they can't speak up when they're offended or hurt or have to share stages with certain people. So I understand it from both sides. So my heart is just a little broken about the fissure that's happening. And I have a great compassion for both sides. So when this came up, I just made a choice to mainly sit it out. It also felt like such a storm was happening. It certainly didn't need my commentary about it. I also don't know the man. I don't know his level of sincerity. I don't know, you know, he said he was, you know, doing a character. I don't have the information,
right?
Because he's new to me, to have an opinion about what he's going for.
yeah.
with any of his work. So I felt uneducated about it.
Did you feel like SNL made the right decision to rescind his offer?
I still don't really have a passionate opinion about it.
Okay.
I generally think that any employer has the right to decide who they want in their workspace.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people talk about it just as cancel culture.
Yeah.
But I'm not in those meetings when they talk to him to get a sense of who he is and what he's going for. And so I can't really speak to, did they cave to pressure or make a choice based on their own morals and values?
Yeah. And you have to imagine that some of the other cast members on the show would have been potentially uncomfortable with him after all that.
It's hard to know. It really depends on who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know who he is, but I know that we all have to make choices about who we want to share space with.
Yeah.
If I'm assembling a writer's room, I'm very aware that I want everyone in that room to get along and like each other and feel safe to split open their unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things that's happened in comedy is that in a writer's room, you are usually told that you're allowed to just let it spill because we're trying to see what bubbles up. And part of that process is to just babble and let things fly. And generally, a writer's room for a sitcom or single camera comedy show is a rough space.
Yeah.
It is not for the faint of heart or the thin skinned. And I think people are debating how far should that go.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of comedians want the ability to do that on stage in front of paying customers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a strong opinion about whether they should be allowed to do that or not.
Right.
For the most part, they should be allowed to do that. But I think that's what's happening is they do want to let it spill off the top of their head on stage. They're not bringing crafted material, you know, to the stage and getting in trouble for it. Usually it's part of working things out and improvising things. And comedians are very worried that they're not going to be allowed to do that. Or if they do that and make a technical mistake, that they're in trouble. And I totally understand what they're talking about. But I also feel like I'm not sure who's getting in trouble.
Yeah.
I don't know what the list is of people who are getting in trouble that has led to such a level of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people who are talking about their fear are doing great.
Yeah, I mean, Dave Chappelle gets brought up a lot, and he's obviously doing quite well and doesn't seem to be in danger of being canceled anytime soon.
It's hard to know what, you know, what the truth of that is.
Yeah.
But that's part of the debate.
Mm-hmm.
I if you talk to comedians, they say it is very difficult. If you go on the road, if you know, a lot of people are yelling in the crowd, you know,
filming,
very difficult to, you know, to perform at colleges. Yes, there are a lot of people looking for you to slip up or looking to be offended by something that you've said.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, a hard place to be if you have the type of act that wants to kick around more difficult ideas, that wants to ruffle feathers, that wants to examine things that people have trouble talking about and getting along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you obviously weighed in on the Louis C.K.'s jokes about the Parkland kids, and we don't need to rehash all of that. But I know you were, besides thinking that those jokes were maybe not, you know, I think you called it hacky, unfunny, and shallow. I feel like the bigger critique of him maybe is that he has not used the opportunity so far to really address what went down with him. And I was curious what you thought about that, his approach to it versus what we saw from Aziz Ansari, who's someone who you've worked with, who came back and did a special and really did talk about this stuff. He made a couple jokes about it, talked about it seriously some. So how do you kind of compare those two approaches to how do you use your platform to address these things?
Well, I, you know, you know, when the movie Trainwreck came out, someone went into a movie theater and killed two women in the audience.
Yeah.
So I'm very sensitive to that subject.
Mm-hmm. Guns and, yeah.
I don't think that people should talk about it recklessly.
Right.
They are allowed to, mm-hmm. and I don't think anybody should be boycotted or not be allowed to work at a club if they make a terrible joke about it. Yeah. I understand that. I did feel like his jokes were especially offensive because those are underage kids, mm-hmm. and they have suffered in a way that no one can ever understand. And there's a real risk of them losing their lives to suicide. There's been a lot of people who have not been able to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And so piling on and making them, you know, the object of ridicule felt so off. Yeah. Now, that being said, I'm all for Louis working on his act. And mm-hmm. I don't think, he should be denied the ability to do what he does. And he'll figure out his path in deciding what the next stage of his creative life is. But I do think comedians should be criticized.
Right.
I do think that it's an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of comedians say, well, I'm not done yet. I'm not done. Criticize me when I have the finished set. Mm-hmm. I don't know. People are paying money. So if someone paid money, they're allowed to have an opinion on what they just saw.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. If I make a movie, people are allowed to trash it.
Mm-hmm.
I put it out, people can trash it. If I go on stage, at the improv, someone could write a blog about what they thought about what I said. That's part of what we do. Mm-hmm. And it's a little disingenuous to think that comedians who criticize everybody
right.
should not be the subject of criticism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want comedians to be kind-hearted, and I'd like comedians to stand for something good generally. But some comedy is just meant to be dark and awful, and some people really enjoy that. They like when people just say the worst thing you ever could say. And I understand there's a release to that, and I enjoy that.
Yeah.
But I felt like with the Parkland kids, they're real. Mm-hmm. We know their names.
Yeah.
And yes, you could do it. You're allowed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're allowed to say, I don't like that you did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I appreciate what Aziz did. And I think a lot of us feel like we wish Louis said that on day one.
Mm-hmm.
And why wouldn't you say it?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you say, I hope people feel better. I'm trying to learn. I hope something good comes from this. I don't want people to be in pain. It seems like the natural thing.
Yeah, he's really seems to have gone hard in the other direction to the point of like emulating some alt-right stuff, which has surprised me.
I don't know what he's thinking, but also he's made a point of not really telling people what he's thinking.
Yeah.
And when he doesn't, it creates this vacuum, and then everyone has to debate it to try to figure out what he's thinking. So that's, I think, why there's so much debate, because he's not saying, this is what I took from this experience. Mm-hmm. And you know what? He will.
Mm-hmm.
One day we'll hear it on stage or in an interview or somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll happen.
I hope that we do, yeah. Coming up, Judd reveals the funniest person he's ever worked with. So before we do wrap up, there's a bit of a speed round that I want to go through some of your IMDb credits and see if there's a story or memory that kind of pops out to you about your time on that. And we've talked about a lot of the stuff already, but we haven't really talked about Freaks and Geeks, which just had its 20th anniversary and is one of my favorite shows of all time. So 20 years later, when you think about that show, how do you think about it? Is there a memory or story that comes to mind?
I don't really think about it in terms of one memory or one story. I'm just very proud of everybody. Mm-hmm. I think that they all continue to do amazing work, and it's shocking how many people have become directors and writers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's almost a giant web of material that came from everyone after the show.
Mm-hmm.
If you looked at just the body of work of everyone that touched Freaks and Geeks, it's just a lot of great stuff. And also everyone is really nice. And it's just a great crew of people. John Daly wrote Spider-Man.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you were crushed at the time when it got canceled after the first season, is there any part of you that now thinks that was a blessing in disguise because you kind of have this one perfect season of the show and you didn't get a chance to to overstay its welcome?
I do think that. I you know, when you do a TV show, you usually have a lot of ideas. Mm-hmm. So if we're working on Crashing with Pete Holmes, we have tons of ideas for years, and we'll think, maybe we should do that as a fourth season arc. Mm-hmm. But when you are pretty sure you're going to get canceled at any second, you just go right to all your A stuff and mm-hmm. see if you can get it done before the guillotine comes down. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why this show is good. It's very compressed. It was made with the fear of it ending every single day.
Mm-hmm. 40-year-old virgin, your first film as a director. What comes to mind when you think about that experience now?
There's always a moment where you're so scared that you won't be allowed to make another one that you go for it really hard. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I directed a movie, and the whole time I thought, if this goes badly, there will not be a second Judd movie. And Carell thought the same thing. He used to say, I'm being really nice to our casting director, so if this bombs, she'll still put me in stuff. Yeah. And as a result, we just worked so hard. We improvised so much material. We overwrote. And we put everyone in it that we thought was riotously funny. And, mm-hmm. and all the parts, if you watch that movie, it's yeah. you know, Kat Dennings is in that movie, and Elizabeth Banks and Jane Lynch, Romney Malco, in addition to, you
Mindy
know,
Kaling,
Seth and Mindy Kaling and Paul Rudd and Leslie. So there was a ton of great comic vibe mm-hmm. when we were doing it. And it's all because Steve had this amazingly simple idea mm-hmm. of the 40-year-old virgin. And we just said, what if you made this movie and you totally respected this character and you tried to handle it in a thoughtful, dramatic way? I think it would become much more mm-hmm. likable and funnier. And I think that approach surprised people.
Mm-hmm. Anchorman was your first movie with Will Ferrell, right?
Yes.
So are there any Will Ferrell stories that jump to mind?
Well, the first thing I shot with Will was an episode of Undeclared.
Oh, yeah.
Our show about college. And Will played a guy who would write your term paper for 50 mm-hmm. bucks. And this was in 2001, I think. He was so funny. At the time, you know, he had been on Saturday Night Live and he had done some small parts in movies. But we would sit on that set blown away by how riotous he was. And then Andy did a lot of improvisations. We were just beginning to figure out a way to shoot these types of things where we did the script, but also would improvise mm-hmm. a lot. And that was very inspired by how Ben Stiller worked at the Ben Stiller Show. And I remember looking at a cut of it and we all said, this is like the type of movie we wish Will Ferrell would make.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted him to be the guy he became. Mm-hmm. So our little episode, we were like, Will Ferrell is the funniest guy ever. I hope we get a ton of movies from mm-hmm. Will
yeah.
before he had been given that opportunity.
Yeah.
Because we knew that this was a very special mm-hmm. guy. So the fact that we were able to do Anchorman afterwards is a great thing.
Speaking of improvising on screen, I feel like the idea of shouting lines off mm-hmm. camera at actors has been both attributed to you and to Adam McKay. Yeah. So do you want to settle that? Who came up with that concept?
I think of it as a Ben Stiller.
Oh, okay.
So because Ben was doing that in 1991. That was how he mm-hmm. worked.
Yeah.
And I certainly encouraged McKay to do it. He would have done it without me for mm-hmm. sure
yeah.
because he came from Saturday Night Live and Second City. But I definitely made a point to tell Adam, you can get a lot of alternate material when you shoot a movie.
Yeah.
Do not think in this format mm-hmm. that you have to shoot the script.
Yeah.
And no one is better than Adam McKay at doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, having gotten a chance to work with Adam as a producer, there's nothing more fun than sitting in a chair watching Adam McKay mm-hmm. feed lines to actors and actresses. There's nobody funnier.
Is there one thing that he shouted out that you can remember that made it in a movie?
The one that I always mentioned is there was a moment in Anchorman 2 where I believe Paul Rudd punches Ron Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just trying to get reactions to this vicious punch. And before every take, Adam, you know, would tell him a new way to approach it. So, you know, it would be, okay, act like he hit you so hard that it put you back into kindergarten. And I was like, now do one where he hits you so hard, you start speaking another language. And it went on and on like that for a long time. And, you know, those are areas that I know as someone who does try to feed lions, I would never get to. Mm-hmm. Like the well is so deep mm-hmm. with McKay.
Knocked Up was the first time you directed your kids.
Yes.
Your two daughters. Is there anything that jumps out from those early times directing your kids?
I wanted them there because I didn't want to meet other people's kids. And I always felt that in movies, when there are children, they always seem like they're not the children of those people. You feel the distance, mm-hmm. the emotional distance. So I knew my kids were interesting. And I also knew they had a dynamic where they would fight that was fun to watch. And if I just turned a couple of cameras on them, you would get it.
You guys want to hear something neat? We're going to have a baby together.
What?
Yeah, baby.
Well, you're not married. Aren't you supposed to be married to have a baby?
You don't have to be.
But they should be, because they love each other, and people who love each other get married and have babies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you love each other?
Yes, they love each other, because that's what you do. When you love each other, you get married and have a baby.
Where do babies come from?
Where do you think they come from?
Well, I think a stork, he drops it down, and then a hole goes in your body, and there's blood everywhere coming out of your head. And then you push your belly button, and then your butt falls off. And then you hold your butt, and you have to dig, and you'll find a little baby.
That's exactly right.
I'm so glad we did it, because it is like having home movies of them when they were kids. And then they just got better and better. So by the time we did This Is 40, you know, they were you know, fully acting and improvising in the way that we do. And then Iris went on to work on our TV show Love on Netflix.
Yeah, she's great on that.
And Maude is now on Euphoria.
Yeah. How's that been for you?
Fantastic. It's I've seen 2.5 episodes. I'm moving very slowly because I'm scared. But you know, she's amazing on the show, and mm-hmm. you know, she's now doing all this on her own, and mm-hmm. is so talented. Yeah. And you know, we couldn't be more proud of her.
Yeah. What did you learn working with Lena Dunham on Girls? What did you learn from her?
It was a similar lesson that I learned from Gary, just a personal, emotional courage in the writing. Mm-hmm. Now, Lena just goes as deep as you can go. That's probably why I was attracted to working with her, mm-hmm. because it felt like Gary.
Yeah.
And when I look back at the show and think about all the things she did and the different ways she exposed herself, it's really remarkable work. And I think she is not spoken of enough as someone who is insanely funny.
Mm-hmm.
She and we had a great time. And one of the things I'm most proud of in my career is that I got to go through that, you know, 7-year experience with Lena, and we got along fantastically the entire time. And there was nothing more fun than just reading her drafts.
Yeah.
You know, she was, you know, very prolific. These shows are very hard to do. When we did the Larry Sanders Show, Gary wouldn't go home for the weekend and write a draft. He would, you know, co-write drafts or tell people ideas. But he didn't do the thing that people like Lena and Pete Holmes and Paul Russ have done, which is, I have an idea, I'm going to go write it, here it is.
Yeah.
And that's a very special gift. Mm-hmm. I see, you know, that Rami does that and mm-hmm. and Aziz. And so to get to read it is fun. You know,
yeah.
Lena going, hey, I wrote something, I thought of something. And then as a fan, wow, this is some incredible writing.
Yeah. So I've had John Lovett on this podcast a couple mm-hmm. times from, who used to work with Obama at the White
yes.
House. So we talked about when you came in to help write some jokes,
yes.
for Obama. So what do you remember from writing jokes for Obama?
Well, I met John at, I was touring the White House and we're walking through and suddenly John Lovett comes out of the president's office.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't met him before, and we're chatting. And he says that they're inside working on jokes for the correspondence dinner. And I'm thinking he's going to say, come on in. You're a comedy writer. Come on in. And then he just didn't. And I was furious. So then at the party after the correspondence dinner, I was just drunk and I would assume he was. And I said, you blocked me. You blocked me. And gave him a really hard time for not letting me in the room with the president. Then the next year he called me up and said, we're working on the speech. Do you want to help out? Mm-hmm. And so he sent me the speech, and a lot of it was looking for subjects which hadn't been developed enough, and just my general reaction to the speech. And they're amazing writers. Whoever's working on it, the jokes are fantastic. If you've ever seen Obama's correspondence speeches,
unbelievable.
They're so funny, but the writing's incredible.
Yeah.
And we started talking about what wasn't in the speech, and I say it was some trepidation, but I definitely was a voice of we should go much harder at Trump.
Yeah,
this, you know, the birtherism thing is crazy,
and this was 2011 when he was maybe going to run against when he was going to run for that nomination,
and he was considering running, and I said to John, he's the worst guy in the world. Mm. We should really do some some tough jokes about him. And we wrote this one extended joke where he recaps an episode of The Apprentice.
It's a classic.
And John said, I don't think he'll do it because it's conceptual. And, you know, he doesn't mind doing these short pop jokes.
Yeah.
But he's not going to do a whole routine.
Yeah.
And then he called me and was shocked to say that he decided to do it.
Hopefully he told him that you wrote it. Maybe that helped.
I did get an autograph from the president afterwards that says on it, thanks for the jokes. You should consider going into comedy. But the next year we had a joke that I really liked, which was a very simple joke where Obama says, a lot of people say to me, you should spend more time with Republicans. You know, you should go get lunch, you know, with Mitch McConnell. And I'm like, you get lunch with Mitch McConnell. I'm paraphrasing the joke.
That holds up.
Joke.
Yeah. Was there anything that you wrote that he wouldn't say?
I'm sure. it was fun to do that. And, you know, Frontline and other places have said, well, that was the moment that Trump decided to run. But clearly Trump was always trying to run.
Yeah.
And Trump himself has said that's not the moment he decided to run for president.
Seth Meyers also shares some of the blame.
I think that Seth Meyers' jokes were way harsher than the president's
probably.
Jokes. When you go back and look at what he said to Trump, it was really brutal.
Yeah.
But I don't think that that's why he ran for president.
No.
He had been talking about it for decades, and that's what helps me sleep at night.
Mm-hmm. So you've worked with just about everybody funny in Hollywood. When you look back, is there a funniest person that you've ever gotten to work with that was funny just in person?
Well, the funniest person when you were in the room with them was Chris Farley.
Yeah.
Nobody was funnier than Chris Farley. By far, because he was just a fireball.
Yeah.
And he was going to go for it hard in almost every single situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to describe what that was, that level of charisma and madness and hilarity. But
what was your experience working with? When did you?
I worked with him on a Tom Arnold special. We did this before he got very famous, where he walked around a mall. And the point of the bit was he was going to teach Tom how to pick up women. And so we had hidden cameras and he just walked up to strangers in the mall and was just talking to women.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be like he's got a yogurt in his hand and there's a woman, you know, 100 yards away, and he would say, oh, hey, how you doing? And then he would just trip and fall on the yogurt, like literally fall flat on this yogurt. So it's just all over his chest and his belly. And then he would keep talking to her as if it didn't happen. Hey, so what are you doing? Are you shopping? And it was just a whole afternoon or day of watching him walk up to strangers And then he was on the Larry Sanders Show as well. And then I would go visit Adam at Saturday Night Live and be around him then. I did some punch up on Black Sheep. Mm-hmm. But he made us laugh more than anyone. On a set, there are certain people and certain moments where people blow you away. Yeah. Where you know you're witnessing the highest level stuff. You know, seeing, Seth and Catherine have some of those conversations during Knocked Up or Leslie when... we were doing the 40-Year-Old Virgin, the drunk driving sequence with her and Steve.
Yeah.
Or Jane Lynch singing in Spanish. most of those moments with Will. There were moments with Sandler during Funny People. Mm-hmm. There's this moment where he's singing this song, Fuck George Simmons, at the piano at the improv that he just improvised that was really funny and haunting. So, but there's 1,000 of those.
Yeah, yeah. And then finally, we end every episode by asking, what's the last piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard? And you can think of it as kind of like a recommendation for people. It could be a stand-up you saw perform or something on TV or a movie or just anything that comes to mind.
When I think about what makes me laugh out loud, like what do I actually make noise and lose it over? The last Sacha Baron Cohen series and Sasha's work in general makes me scream and laugh and cringe in the best possible way. All his movies, everything he's done. I could go on YouTube and look at old Ollie G's. I was just watching him, an old one where he interviewed David Beckham and Victoria Beckham. The whole family, we just decided to just watch this old Ollie G interview. Extras is a show that made me laugh out loud really hard. The David Bowie episode is pretty incredible. I'm trying to think like things that made me scream. You know, there's moments in This Is the End.
Yeah.
Seven Evans movie that
I love that movie.
That are genuinely riotous. And I'm trying to think of somebody else. Maria Bamford, anything Maria Bamford does.
Yeah, I would say, when I at the Largo show, I was crying laughing at the Gary Gulman's Chipotle bit.
Yes.
That really got me.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny.
So I don't know if that's an old bit or a new bit, but I hope it's on the next thing that he puts out so people can see that.
Yeah, there's so many people who are so great right now.
Yeah.
It really is an amazing time.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Judd Apatow for inviting us into his office to record this episode. It's Gary Shandling's book is available for pre-order right now at the link in the description for this episode and will be in stores on Tuesday, November 12th. And Staten Island is scheduled to hit theaters sometime next year. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazel. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!